And, hey, it is midday, last day. I'm always sad because that means I got to go home and I don't have you guys to talk to. So, this is going to be our last session together, but there's some other great sessions this afternoon. One in particular I'd point you to is I'm going to be talking about IPAM, the IP Address Manager. And I'm not going to be talking about the R2 version. And a fellow in the networking team, Prabhu, is going to do a talk about that, which would be really, really good. Anyway, so my plan here is that I want to talk to you. There's all kinds of things to cover, many, many things that we could cover. And in 75 minutes, because I've done this talk a few times, although I rewrote it today, but it's hard to get much more than about four things done. So that's what I'm going to focus on, and I'm happy to answer questions afterwards about other stuff. I did get two questions on DNSSEC, so I'll do that really quickly. DNSSEC didn't change much, except now it is fully compliant with standards, and if you right-click a folder, it will sign a zone immediately. It's wonderful. It's automatic. It's lovely. I want to talk about some PowerShell tools. You might have heard that I think PowerShell is pretty cool, and I'm hoping that you are going to think that PowerShell is pretty cool also when we get done here. I want to talk about software nick teaming. Software nick teaming is a cool feature. This falls in the category of if you've decided to go with 2012, has anyone here implemented any Server 2012 systems? Wow. So if you've already bought the things, guess what? You've got some cool free stuff. I want to talk to you about the IP Address Manager. It's okay for what it does. It's changing tremendously in R2. As I said, if you want to find out more, go to Prabhu's talk. And then DHCP failover. DHCP failover, this is where we can have a two-node DHCP failover cluster. So, sound good? Is that what you came for? Talk to me, guys. Okay, good. So, we're going to do a lot of PowerShell. And so, when I asked a bunch of people the question the other day, I said, how many of you are real experts at PowerShell? How many real experts at PowerShell do I have? Okay, like six. So, how many of you have PowerShell on your list of stuff you really want to learn to get better at? You got to. Okay. So, experts, I apologize. I'm going to bore you for one slide, okay? May I? So, first of all, PowerShell commands, which are called commandlets. And the reason they're called that is that Jeffrey Snover, who created it, wanted a word that if you Googled it, I'm sorry, if you Binged it, then you would only get PowerShell information. They're commands, and they all look like a verb dash a noun, like get-ad-user. Get-ad-user is a commandlet that will dump. I'm not giving you the exact syntax. I'm simplifying things a bit. But it's a command that will dump out the list of your Active Directory users. So get is the verb, ad-user is the noun. Important thing about nouns, the nouns are always singular. It's never get-ad-users, it's get-ad-user. Okay? There's a very limited set of verbs, and that's important. That is particularly important, folks, because, and by the way, is there a chance we can get the lights like they were before, pretty please? Because that way I can see everybody and they can see me. That'd be just terrific. I think we should still be able to see the PowerPoint because I tested it with those. Like, that's terrific. Thank you. Now I can see you all, and you can see me. Good. Okay, cool. The big four, I call them. New, get, set, remove. They had to pick a word. And the PowerShell team are great because they're very strict about you can't start making up verbs. So new creates things. What's the noun for an Active Directory user? AD user. What did I just tell you? You don't have to look in the documentation. You know that the command that creates a new user account. Creating new users is different and more fun, right? So to create a new account is new-ad-user. Does that make sense? What if I tell you that the virtualization team came up with the following noun for virtual machine? VM. What's the command going to be to create a new virtual machine? New-VM. That makes sense? That's the beauty of PowerShell. If you came to my class or anybody else's class, I spend the first hour on one command. But once you've got it, the other one's bam, 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 bam. It looks ugly when you first see it. You'll be astounded how quickly it gets easy. Get, that's the safe one. It shows us what we've got. If I want to see all my AD users, get-AD user. What do I do to see all my virtual machines? Get-VM. Does this make sense? Good so far? Set lets us tweak things. If you want to change my title in Active Directory, my guess would be set-ad user. Set-ad user. And remove deletes things. So notice, we never use the word create. We never use the word show. We never use the word list. By holding the number of verbs down, it becomes easy for you to guess what's going to get the job done for you. So how do we get rid of a virtual machine? Remove-VM. How do I delete a process from a task list? Remove-process. Is it remove-processes? No, always singular. So that's just a little bit. And parameters start with a dash, like set-a to user, mark dash title speaker. That's that good? Because we're going to be doing lots of PowerShell. All right. So there's a whole pile of new PowerShell commands, literally over 1,000 networking commands when all said and done. I believe that is the case. So how many of you have ever needed to configure a NIC from the command line? Maybe you need a script. Maybe you need it for documentation. If you're not a fan, because is there anybody here who really doesn't want to learn PowerShell because it looks like a lot of work? I won't ask you to raise your hand. You know. How many of you don't want to do PowerShell at all? I just want to see who won't be here next year. That's all. No, seriously. I understand the initial, you know, oh my God, that's a lot. But the cool thing about doing something with PowerShell is that once the command works, you can copy it right off the command line, stick it in Notepad, and you've just written documentation to rebuild your network. So, has anybody ever had to configure IP configurations from the command line? You probably use NetSH, which is the penalty for shoplifting in 13 states, having to use NetSH. I've seen people do it through the registry. If you're very, very manly, then you can, you know, drive your way into the registry and you can change your IP from the registry. That's very, very manly. Aye, from back in the days when men were men and sheep were nervous. Aye. So, I don't know why that guy sounded Scottish, because my, anyway, so. So rename-netadapter, if you ever need to do this, what's the default names? Well, the default names have gotten better. Right out of the box, it used to be local, space, area, space, connection. Oh, thank you, Microsoft. Obviously, you guys never script. Don't put spaces in my names. Now, it's just Ethernet. Very nice. Of course, the second one is Ethernet space 2, but you can't have everything. Wireless is no longer wireless space, network space connection. It's now Wi-Fi. I know you guys say Wi-Fi, but you know how it works, right? So, all right. How about setting an address? New-net IP address. And this isn't bad. This says what NIC to do it on, what the address is. What's prefix length? Well, prefix length is another way of representing a subnet mask. Something called CIDR notation. We've seen it ever since, I think, 1992. RFC 1918, I believe it is. I could be wrong about that. No, it's not 1918. I'm sorry. It's anyway. So get-netadapter, what's that going to do? The nouns netadapter, what will get-netadapter do? Anybody? It will make me a list, right? Of what? Of my NICs. It will list my NICs for me. But then I can take the output of that and run it through a command called where. Where lets me filter. And don't worry about the syntax of this too much. But this example says, show me all my adapters where the link speed is greater than 10 gigabits per second. So some of this starts to look a little familiar, like some commands we've been using for a long time. Here's another one. Disable a network adapter. Set a net adapter's MAC address. You can set its VLAN ID. Now, I want to caution you, that doesn't work for everything. The commandlet can only do what the driver allows, and as I'm sure you know, some network drivers will not allow you to change a MAC address. That make it sense? Questions, anybody? Please ask me questions as we go along. Because it reminds me of something. You know, I think it was 21 years ago that I met ipconfig. 21 years ago was the first time that Microsoft released a TCP/IP stack that was free and worked in Windows. It was awesome. I had TCP to play with. I'd have to buy that lizard gecko stuff. So, and the code name was Wolverine. Why we name things after smelly, unpleasant animals, I have no idea. So I got this loaded, and there was a new command line tool, ipconfig. Ipconfig's 21 years old enough to drink in all 50 states. Okay? And I love ipconfig. We've been using it for years, haven't we? But you know, like a lot of my friends, as the years go on, he's gotten a little thicker around the waist and a little dopier upstairs, you know? Because now there's all kinds of crap in it. It just, the crap just keeps increasing. Anybody remember Vista? First time I ran, here, it's like this. So first time I ran an ipconfig/all in Vista, a terrible thing happened. Are you ready? Does anyone here have a weak heart? It scrolled off the screen. No. There was a great disturbance in the force. It was as if a million IT pros had cried out at the same time. For years, I've been asking for ipconfig/no BS, you know? If I could just have an XML file that would let me say, only tell me this, not that. And I've been thinking, I'm going to fix it. I learned C++, kind of, taught myself a few years ago. I've been thinking, I'm going to find some time and start, but I never seemed to find the time. But then, PowerShell came along. PowerShell's got all these great net commands. And one Saturday last December, you know, 2012 had just come out, Windows 8 had just come out, I was sitting there on the command line. You probably do that on a Saturday morning too, just kind of trying out PowerShell commands. I understand that. Right? You guys are like me. And I said, now wait a minute. Well, this is cool. That command gives me the IP address. That command gives me the subnet mask. That command gives me the DNS suffixes. That command gives me the NICs. I'm like, my old friend ipconfig, I thought he was dying. But I heard a voice behind me say, we have the technology. We can rebuild him. And so I spent like 3 hours farting around with get this, get that, get the other thing. And then I figured out how to print stuff out. And I spent most of my time formatting it so it looked like ipconfig. And then I built it into a PowerShell module. This is how easy this is. I never went to school for computers. I'm trained to the PhD level in economics. I was a Washington economist. I know, you've heard about them. Yes, I did it for a while. It's not honest work. One president once said, Harry Truman said, bring me a one-armed economist. They said, why, Harry? And he says, so he can't say on the other hand. You know? Anyway, so I read up on modules, and I clocked myself. It took me 4 hours to put the whole thing, the module, together and have it work the first time. I am not a genius, I'm not a programmer, and I made it work. And I bet most of you are way smarter about this stuff than I am. You want to see it? You want to see it? Okay. It's really not a new 2012 feature, so I shouldn't be doing it in my talk, but I'm very proud of it. I call it get-ip-info. Ready? It scrolled off the screen before. Look at that. But you haven't noticed the best parts. So, first of all, notice that the subnet mask is smashed up against the IP address, saving a line of output. Yes, yes. We have our speeds. And I love this because it shows me that the show net is 26 million bits per second at the moment. It's lying. And where we got it from, DHCP covers all the IPv6 stuff and things like that. So is that amazing? Friends, what would you pay for a tool like this? Perhaps $5, perhaps $10, maybe €3. Well, if you act now and download from my site, newsletter 102, you can learn how to build this for yourselves. But wait, there's more. I'm working on a new one. It's not done yet. And I probably shouldn't test it in front of you, but why not? Get this IP info 2. I added a separate analysis module. This is complicated because it's a show net, so let's see what it does. Okay? So there is the analyze the network. And then what? Don't. I think my app needs sensitivity training. I better get back to the PowerPoint so I don't get kicked out of here. Let's see. All right. So, seriously, fantastic stuff. There's another thing I want to show you, by the way. So, This is a weird thing you're going to see about PowerShell command line in 2012, is that, so if I run something like, I guess I can do it on my machine. So if I say get-netadapter, here's what it shows me. It says you've got two network adapters, one's called Ethernet, one's called Wi-Fi, shows me some stuff. But that's not a lot of information. Where's that link speed? This is an interesting thing. PowerShell, when you run a PowerShell commandlet, it is usually the case that the PowerShell commandlet knows more than it's telling you. Yes. Every time, almost, that you run a PowerShell commandlet, because I want you to understand this because it upset me the first time I saw it. What does that mean? I'll tell you what it means, friends. It thinks that PowerShell thinks that we can't handle the truth. But we have ways of making you talk, PowerShell. And so, I want to show you how to make them do it. If I do that same command, and I pipe it into select star, there's different ways to do it. I'm going to show you a simple one. Select star, that's to show me everything. I get lots more information. But it's not very readable. So maybe we do something else. Let's run that command again. Let's pipe it into another cool tool, out-grid-view. I just have to learn how to type. You ready? It brings up this thing that looks like a spreadsheet. Isn't that kind of cool? Oops. I messed up, guys. I thought I had Zoomit loaded already. Recinovich will never let me hear the end of this. So here I'm seeing information, more detailed information. All of these columns, you can sort on the columns. You can remove columns. It's like having a little spreadsheet. Now, I know the question you're going to ask, can I save this as an Excel? No. As a matter of fact, you can't save it at all. It's still nice. It's a great way of seeing big whacks of data. It's a really, really, really nice tool. That's called the grid view. This is what I really want, though. That would be cool, but that doesn't work. So, not in this version. Okay. So. Okay. Good. Yes. Please. Question. You know, there's always a guy who pitches it across the plate. But yes. So the answer was, now wait a minute, Mark. You're an ignorant fool. Something like that. You could take the output, and there's all kinds of exports. An export-csv is a commandlet that will do that for you. You can then export it to a.xml. Then you'd fire up Excel. Then you'd I'm tired already. See, I want to export straight to XML. Straight to Excel. Next version, PowerShell 5. I'm announcing right now. Don't tweet that. So, questions? Anybody else got a question? All right, good. So, lots more stuff. We have, how many of you have to run DNS servers? Okay. You know, the DNS snap-in, the GUI is pretty good, but the fact is if you're trying to do things in bulk, you know that it's not so good for that. The DNS CMD is a nice tool, and it's gotten better over the years, but these guys are awesome. We have 100 server commandlets, and there's one I got to tell you. I wish I had time to run you through all of them. Maybe that's a talk I should pitch for next year. Let's just do PowerShell DNS or something. But anyway, you do get-DNS server. It dumps stuff about the server I didn't know the server had. It just goes on and on and on and on and on. And if you take it and pump it out to CLI XML, and you save that file. Have you ever had to take a DNS server and do an identical configuration on a bunch of other DNS servers? Piece of cake. You just get this one XML file. You then do the import XML into set DNS server. Done. It does not copy the zones over. You have got to rebuild those. But, oh, by the way, there's a few commands for that, too. So if you want to create a zone, for example, then you're going to say you could say add-DNS-server-primary-zone-z. The z means this is going to be file-backed. The rep means it's going to be Active Directory-backed. Very nice, very clean, nice syntaxy stuff. So quite good. So this is some nice tests. And so there's a whole bunch of great new things. 103 new DHCP commands as well. So it's just really terrific stuff. Questions on that, anybody? Okay. RDMA is an acronym that you're going to be hearing more and more of. It means Remote Direct Memory Access. RDMA, Remote Direct Memory Access. What's that mean? Has anybody here worked with RDMA boards? I almost never get any hands. Here's what it is. You've got a data center. You've got to move some data from here about 15 meters over that way. You want fast. You could use a 10 gigabit Ethernet card. They're friggin' expensive. So this RDMA thing is like a NIC, but you can't route it, and it really doesn't go over long distances. I think it's like 30 meters is the most the cable runs. It's a weird-looking cable. Some of them use standard Ethernet cables. Some use other ones. Here's the point. Well, the question is, what is the point? If I want to move a big whack of data from one side of the data center to the other, not long distance, but high speed, I know what you normally do. Put the servers up high so the data goes downhill. I understand, but that doesn't give you the speed that you need. And so the closest analogy is it's 1987. You have two 386s, and you want to move some data really fast from one to the other, you get a special parallel port cable, plug it into both sides, and run a program called LapLink. Anybody remember that? Yeah, I know I'm old. So it's a special purpose. The interesting thing is that Microsoft has said, you know what, we can use that. Microsoft wants you to be able to build in some senses, Server 2012 can be described in just a few words. It is a finely honed missile pointed directly at VMware. I don't work for Microsoft, and it took me like 9 months to figure, like, oh. One day it's like, oh. Well, crap, now I understand it, you know. I'd been teaching about it and playing with the different pieces, and then one day I was like, and if I did, oh. Oh, that, and then it goes, and oh. Sell my VMware stock, please. It's just, so one of the things is you want to be able to build clusters that are super fast. You can now run SMB, regular old net use stuff you've known for the last 30 years. You can run SMB on top of these RDMA boards. Very interesting stuff. Start looking into it. Okay. I want to talk to you next about NIC teaming. So that was our PowerShell stuff. We'll do some more PowerShell stuff. What is it? How many of you here have ever worked with teamed NICs of any kind? That's a lot of you. Okay. So I'll go over what it's for. The beauty of this is teamed NICs from a vendor is a beautiful thing, but it costs money. It may be trouble to manage because some of the tools that I've worked with are a little wonky. And you can't mix NICs. You can't mix like a Dell NIC and an HP NIC and a team. So what this is going to do for you, well, here's what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you why you care. We'll talk about what it does for you. And then what you need to know to configure it, because it's a really neat feature. This may be the best feature I'm going to show you because it's going to save you a lot of money. If you've already got Server 2012 and you've already got servers, I guarantee you that most of you will be able to do a couple clicks, or better yet, a single PowerShell command, and get yourself some extra performance, okay? So that's my plan. What's it do? So imagine I've got three NICs on my system. Three NICs on my system. What am I going to get out of that? If I turn on NIC teaming, here's the first thing I get. I get three times as much outflow. I can pump out three times as much data as I would with one NIC. So outbound always works. I may get three times as much inbound if I have the right switches. If not, I don't get an in. If I don't have the right switches, I don't get faster inbound. And I also get failover. If a NIC fails, then something else will step in and take its place. And in certain configurations, if a switch fails, then it'll take over. Why is that good for you? This is the scenario I want to talk to you guys about. And this is the only reason. I wouldn't put this in the presentation if I didn't think it would save you some money. Yes, sir, please. What does it mean, the right switches? That's a great question. It's good to have a shill in the audience. Have we ever met before, sir? That's right. It's like three slides from now. It was almost perfect, man. I promise I will answer all questions, but thank you. It's always fair to ask that question. Is the strange man going to wander off and not explain that? No, I'm going to explain that. Okay, so when you roll a server, in a little 1U server onto your racks, how many NICs are on that server? It depends, right? I want to say two. Those are the ones I've seen. I don't do a lot of work in data centers. A lot of my clients tell me there's sometimes four NICs on server boards, right? I've heard six. So if that happens, you roll this board in, it's got two NICs, four NICs, six NICs. How many do you plug in? One. Right. What this is going to do is you plug a cable in, you click one command, and the worst thing that happens is that nothing's any worse. But the chances are very good you're going to get some performance. That's the reason I want to talk to you about it. So if you'll permit me, let's spend a few minutes on it. So Nick Teaming, its official name at Microsoft is Network Load Balance and Failover. There's a guy at Microsoft who comes up with sexy names for new stuff. And I'm telling you, he's firing on all cylinders when it comes to Server 2012. So it's LBFO. And if you Google it or Bing it or whatever, I get in trouble when I use Google in my PowerPoints because at some point the Microsoft guys always say, Google, what's that? So I change it to Bing. And you know, that's anyway. And why do we Bing? Because it's not Google. B-I-N-G. Because. You didn't know that? You didn't know that? Serious. It's not true, but it's a great story. Okay, so you can use any NIC or combination of NICs. You got a Dell NIC, you got an Ethernet NIC, you got an Intel NIC. Doesn't matter. They'll all work together. You can mix up speeds, but that may be a bad idea, and I'll talk about that. The RDMA boards I just talked about can't do that. I want to tell you about things I've tested and things I've heard. It says you can use up to 32 NICs in a system. I have to report to you that I don't have any servers that have 32 NICs on their motherboards. So that's just projectorware. That's what I've been told by the nice Microsoft people. And you can do it from Server Manager, and you can also do it from PowerShell. So I want to give you a feeling for what it does. And I, by the way, I recognize that many of you have worked with NIC teaming. I hope I'm not boring you. I just didn't know whether, you know, some of you said you haven't. So let's just quickly talk about how it works. So outbound traffic goes across all your NICs. If I had a 3-NIC system, so what have I got? I've tripled the outbound traffic. What about the inbound traffic? Well, it depends. Got to have the switches. Here's an interesting point about the outbound, though. Any given TCP conversation doesn't get spread. So if you're doing a file transfer from my website of a 10-gigabyte file, and I got 5 NICs, do we get any speed improvement? We don't. Because if you're actually, it depends. But if we're transferring data from my web server to you, the chances are good it's one TCP connection. Now, why does Microsoft not break up a TCP connection? Very simple. It would be nice. If I've got 5 NICs, that means I got 2 gigs going down one and 2 gigs going down the other, and pretty good. The problem is, though, that if we bust up a TCP connection across many NICs, what are we going to do? The receiver has to keep track of a lot of blocks that come out of order. And so Microsoft made the judgment call, I think it was the right call, that within any particular TCP conversation, it doesn't get broken up. Does that make sense? Has anybody got a question on that? Please. Oh, okay. Okay, good, good. Thank you. Anybody got a question on that? Great. Okay, then. Failover happens when you lose a NIC. But the important thing, my question is always, well, how is it smart enough to do that? And the answer is it doesn't have to be smart. It's just, you got the fact is you have more than one NIC, you're doing TCP communications, and TCP normally, naturally does retries. One of the things I like best about this is there's no weird protocol. There isn't some imaginary new proprietary Microsoft thing that only works when you're talking to other Microsoft servers. That's not what's happening. This is simple TCP. This will work if you're talking to Linux boxes. It'll work if you're using any kind of network cards. Does that make sense? All right, here's the thing, though. Let's talk about that switch thing. So I love this, the software NIC teaming feature. The things you've got to configure, though, I'm not happy about the labels. I think they might have worked a little harder on making it clear. So I'm going to walk you through this stuff. Now, it's the switches. Ever since NIC teaming appeared, you need switches that are smart enough to work together for incoming. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to say that any enterprise-level switch built in the last 10 years can do teaming. Is that about right? That's at least what I've seen. And there's two kinds, by the way. So there's basically three kinds of switches. One are the ones that don't understand NIC teaming at all. Two are the really old ones that know NIC teaming. They're sometimes called static NIC teaming. Why? They're called static because you have to configure them by hand. You've got to fire up your telnet or something like that and talk to your switch, or maybe it's got a web interface if it's a newer one, and from there configure NIC teaming. Is everybody good with that? I know some of you know this. If you're the person that doesn't do this, don't be quiet because nobody else is asking. I'm talking to you. Does this make sense so far? About 10 years ago, the link aggregation control protocol comes around. It's an IEEE number I can never remember. And its job is you don't have to configure them. You just plug them in, and 99 times out of 100, they work. So LACP. So three levels. We've got switches that don't understand it at all. We've got the older switches that you got to configure by hand, but they'll still do teaming. And then there's the automatic ones, which is most of what you've purchased, your company's purchased in the last 10 years. Questions on that? Anybody? And in answer to the question, how do you know? You got to look in the manual. I mean, it's not like they have a LACP logo or something like that, okay? So part of your LBFO configuration is figuring out and telling what kind of switches you've got. So you want to set up. So you say you want to set up a switch. You want to set up a NIC team, do you? Well, at this point, think of a movie that I think every IT pro has seen. Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Am I right? Okay. Well, they're at the Gorge of Eternal Peril, and they're trying to get across this gorge, but the old man gets in the way. And what does he say? Answer me these questions three. Err the other side, you see. So there's three questions we've got to answer. You ready? What is your favorite? No, sorry. It's not what is your favorite color. It's you got to tell it what kind of switch you got. You got to tell it whether you're doing Hyper-V or not. And you got to tell it if you want to do active and standby. That's failover. I will describe all of these guys. So those are three questions. What kind of switch? Is Hyper-V involved? And in what way? And then we're going to do active standby. So one at a time. Teaming mode. So tell me about your switches. Now, if your switches, here's a clue, okay? So three settings. Switch independent. Switch dependent and LACP. Remember I said there's three kinds of switches? The dumbass switches that don't do anything? Switch independent. The older NIC teaming switches that you got to configure? That's switch dependent. Some people call them static teaming. Most of the ones built in the last 10 years, the big ones that a company would buy, LACP. So those are your options. It's switch independent, switch dependent, LACP. Are we okay so far? Now, let me talk about a little bit more of that. How do you know? Well, you could look at the manual, but here's a clue. If your switches say Netgear, Linksys, or Belkin, go with switch independent, okay? So. Now, there's other reasons to use switch. There are three reasons to use switch independent. The three reasons are A, Linksys, Netgear, Belkin. That's one reason. So if you know it's dumb. The second reason is this. What if you want to say, I like this failover stuff. I got three NICs and three cables. I'm going to run them through three different switches. That makes some sense. If you do that, it has to be switch independent. So, A, you know you got stupid switches. B, you're going to run more than one switch. C, you don't know. If you don't know, you can never go wrong saying switch independent. It'll be a little slower. You won't get the incoming benefits, but the outgoing will still be fine. So the whole point is, you can never go wrong saying switch independent. Yes, sir, please.
If you've got link connections between two separate switches, can you use it
in? If you've got link connections between two, so if they're effectively like one switch, yeah, you're fine. Then you can go with the switch dependent LACP. Okay. And by the way, it's super easy to try it. I mean, so if you plug it in and it doesn't work, you'll know immediately. So switch independent, you can never go wrong with it. But it may be slower than it might be. And again, don't be afraid to try it. Questions, anybody? Move along to the next question then. What about load balancing? Load balancing says, I got three NICs. I want to put some data on this NIC, some data on this NIC, some data on this NIC. How do I spread it out? Typically, we just use an address hash of some kind. It's super simple. In 99.something% of the cases, address hash. And by the way, that's the default. What's the default here? Switch independent. The safe one. Good work, Microsoft. What's the case here? Address hashing is typically the thing that's used to do load balancing. But in a very specific edge case. You ready for the very specific edge case? Anybody ever heard here of SRIOV? Okay, SRIOV is where I take a physical NIC and I give it to a virtual machine. You could do it in Hyper-V 2012. If you want to team a bunch of those NICs, if you've taken a bunch of physical NICs and bonded them to a particular virtual machine, don't say address hash, it won't work. Instead, say Hyper-V. Does everybody understand this? Everybody thinks, oh, if I'm near a Hyper-V switch, no, no, no. Don't ever turn on Hyper-V. And that's unless you have two or more SRIOV boards in the team. Is that making sense? Questions, anybody? So far, if I'm just doing it like this, what do I do? Switch independent, which is the default. Address hash, which is the default. Cool. Let's see what the third one is. Third one is active or standby. Normally, all three NICs are active. If you want to, you can say to one of them, hey, we want you on the team, but you got to stay on the bench. The idea here is it's a standby. The only example I can think of is this. What if you had a computer, you had a server, it's got a 1 gigabit NIC on the motherboard, and you buy a 10 gigabit NIC. So you got a 1 gig and a 10. Should you team them? Well, let me back up. Can you team them? Yes. Is it a good idea? Maybe not. And why? Because if we had a team consisting of a 1 gigabit NIC and a 10 gigabit NIC, what happens? Half of the traffic goes over the 1 gig and half of the traffic goes over the 10 gig. You don't want that. But this kind of team would work. The exception to that rule is, all right, you bought that expensive 10 gigabit NIC, you put it on your server, oh, but there's a 1 gig already sitting there. Plug it in, make it part of the team, but say, I want you dead until the expensive guy dies. Just sleep until the expensive guy dies. So that's active standby. That's active slash standby. Does that make sense? Questions, anybody? Cool. So what am I saying to you? Take the cable, plug it in, just turn the thing on. Don't worry about the settings. The default settings are good, and then you can improve upon them later if you want to. How would we do this? May we do this? I've got screenshots, but let's do a live demo. Because let me tell you something about TechEd Europe. Speakers say that you guys are the scariest audience on the planet. And if we mess up a demo, we die. That's just all there is to it. So I'm not too worried about doing a demo here. Now, this is the server manager interface. How many of you have seen the server manager interface on 2012? Isn't it awesome? So, first of all, I want you to see all green. Good administrator. I love that they have this little red. That way when the boss walks by, it's like, there's a red line. Do something about that. So here I'm going to go over to local server. And then I've got NIC teaming, and it doesn't say nothing. It was thinking about it. And so actually, now it says NIC teaming disabled right there. I got a couple of NICs, internal and internal two. One's not connected to anything. The other one's got a static address. So there's internal and internal two. All right. I'm going to click NIC teaming. And now the user interface comes up. Now, I find the Server 2012 Server Manager interface a little bit confusing, and maybe you do too. Because I don't know about you, but I heard a long time ago that all caps are just not the thing to do. That all caps are like yelling at someone. Apparently, in the new style guide, you can be all caps if you're a very short font. That's the rule, apparently. So it's shouting, but not very loud. So I see here that it tells me I have a server, and notice we have the Microsoft made all the icons simpler. No more 64 color icons, no more 15,000 color icons. This was just the style guide says every icon should have two colors, white and something else. And so there we got a little icon, says we're online, life is good, everybody's happy. We don't have no teams right now. Notice there are no teams currently, and there's nothing up my sleeve. So I wonder how I'll make one. Let's see. The thing that I do is I start clicking tasks, and according to tasks, I can make a new team. It's interesting that new team isn't all caps. I'm confused. Are you? Actually, no, really. The server manager is an awesome interface, and you know why? Because when you've used it for 15 minutes, you say, oh, teach me PowerShell. Please, teach me PowerShell. It's a brilliant move. Once again, Microsoft has done the right thing. And they don't get credit for this stuff. I don't know why. It's just not fair. It's just not fair. So let's see. Tasks and new team. I'm going to make that guy and that guy. Do you get that checkbox thing? Very complicated, you know, so let's see. And then we say, oh, got to give it a name. Nick Team 1. Additional properties. That's where we're going to change those other things if we want to. But in this case, we're perfect. Click OK. It thinks about it. Up there, see that saving? Aha. And then see, it's barking at me here because the media is disconnected. And the funny thing is when it sits there for a little bit, it stops barking. And I get the warning, switch independent. Danger, Will Robinson. So I have a Nick team at this point. Pretty exciting, huh? But you know, that was a lot of clicking. I wonder if there's another way. So let's get rid of this thing. Delete. Delete the team. It may take it a second. There we are. And remember, in Nick teams, there's no I in team. There's me, though, if you move the letters around. So it's... Okay. Let's go back to the real server manager. Now, this PowerShell stuff's pretty hard. So let's see. What's the verb going to be to create a new team? What's the verb going to be? New. New really isn't a verb, I know, but... You want to see a real weird command in PowerShell? Get-verb. Shows you all the verbs. But you know what the weird part is? In this command, the noun is verb. That's not right. That's just not right. So, new-netlbfo-team. Okay? And then I got to give it a name. And the parameter is name. That was tricky. And then nickteam1 dash, and I don't want to type this out, so I know it starts with T. Team members. I could never remember whether it's team member, team members. That's why I press tab. Internal, comma, internal 2. Does that sound good so far? Is that text big enough? Can you guys see that in the cheap seats? Yes? Okay, good. So, oh, but there's one thing. For some reason, PowerShell wants me to always say, are you sure? And I was born sure. And I see what it's trying to do. Because if I type this right now, this is what's going to happen. It's going to say, gosh, you sure you want to do that? Because, I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, this could be like Friday night. I got me some tequila. And I'm sitting by the command prompt. I can't figure out why I'm still single. And I'm just typing random stuff, press enter, and oh my God, not a Nick team. Oh, thank you. You saved me, PowerShell. So we can get past that. When PowerShell's going to do like that are you sure thing, it has two ways to do it. And one way, it looks like this. Dash confirm, firm, colon, dollar sign, false. So, in other words, that's saying, should I confirm or should I not confirm? The syntax is a little weird. I totally agree. You know, PowerShell is like, you know, 95% totally great, does weird stuff sometimes. Now, what's that dollar sign false? The dollar sign false, some of you will know this because you've done programming stuff. Dollar sign false is an example of a variable called a Boolean. Booleans can only have two values, true and false, Republican, Democrat, you know, whatever, stuff like that. So what's the dollar sign false? It's the variable. It's the value that contains false. Why is the dollar sign there? The dollar sign is there because in PowerShell, if you have a place where you store something, a variable, it would be used in some languages, you know it's a variable because it starts with dollar sign. Dollar sign is always the first name. If I were to create some kind of game in PowerShell and the first question was, hi, what's your name? I would store your name in dollar sign user or something like that. If you create a variable, its name is dollar sign. Make sense? So dollar sign false is false. Does that make sense? Is there something wrong with that, though? Because dollar, what do you think true is? Take a wild guess. What's the variable that contains true? Dollar sign true, yeah. What's wrong with that? I'll tell you what's wrong with that. Variable? Truth is not variable. That's what's wrong with this world. No, the real reason is that constants also have the dollar signs. Okay? Does this all make it sense? Again, my PowerShell experts, I'm really, really sorry I'm going through this stuff, but everybody else needs it. Because next year, assuming they let me come back, then I want all hands to go up. Okay? So. Was this hard? I mean, I'm going to argue this is pretty easy. It seems pretty simple to me. And the best part is, once I've got it done, I copy and paste it. Open up a OneNote. Open up a OneNote document called PowerShell Stuff I Got to Work. Because if it takes you more than 30 seconds, it's crazy to have to figure it out more than once. Or I use Outlook Yellow Notes. I have 577 of them. And they sync to my iPad. They don't sync to my Surface. And it's not RT's fault. It's just that the Outlook team can't figure out how to do RT. But they are now, so that's going to get better. So questions on this? Anybody? We can add some extra options if we want to. And, by the way, this is interesting to me. So I used to have NICs called what? Internal and Internal 2. And they had IP addresses. Not anymore. Now they disappear. I have a NIC called NIC Team 1, and it needs an IP address. So I have to go set an IP address for this thing. And I want to make sure I can do that so that my next demonstration is going to continue to work. That's assuming I get time to do the next demonstration. So, and by the way, I can see that right now. If I type ipconfig, oh-ho! Internal is gone, internal 2 is gone, and we now have a NIC called NIC Team 1. Notice it has that, 169 address thingy. So we could change that. We could do it from PowerShell. Anybody remember the command? new-net IP address. There was a lot of parameters there. You're thinking, he's going to type that from memory? Hell no, I'm 55. So there's a great little command that arrived in PowerShell 3 that makes even complicated PowerShell easy to run. show-command new-net IP address. That sounds right. Let's see if that works. See, it turns it into a GUI tool. So it shows me things like that there's two options. I can refer to the interface by its alias, new NIC team, or was it NIC team 1, or by its IF index. If I go this way, it then shows me with asterisks what's essential, what's the minimum essential. So let's see what I'm going to do here. I'm going to say NIC team 1. With an IP address of 10.0.0.1. And then I'm going to add some other stuff. Default gateway, sure. Let's point it to itself. Prefix length. Prefix length is how many ones are in the subnet mask. That's the /24 stuff. The only thing that's missing here is I kind of wish that the network team had put a space in here for a DNS server. But we're going to fix that in a minute. Does everybody see what I'm doing? Even a complicated PowerShell commandlet that you can't remember, just cheat. Do show command. And then once you're done, oh, look what we got down there. Run, copy, cancel. I'm going to run it. Fingers crossed. Looks like something happened. But we still need a DNS address. No problem. set-dns client server address. I don't know. Interface index? I don't want to do interface index. And by the way, I don't type that quickly. I'm just using tab to do my work for me. And by the way, PowerShell has an integrated script editor. It worked with it that I don't want to scare you with, but it's really cool. It gives you all the IntelliSense stuff that you'd like. I put in the name, NIC Team 1. I believe that's the name. /server addresses. And the address of the DNS server is that machine right there. I think that'll do the job. I could be wrong. All right. Let's see if I did it right. How about an ipconfig /all? And what have we got? We got that NIC Team 1 does indeed have an IP address, and it's the preferred IP address. Huh. It's got a preferred other address, too. There's a lot of preferred addresses here. Has IP become the unsure protocol? So the subnet mask is what I expected. Default gateway, I must have messed up. How did I mess up default gateway? Maybe I forgot to put it in. DNS servers. All right, I did that. I did that because I'm hoping that I can convince you that these PowerShell commandlets are useful and they're not terribly hard to make work. All right? Back to our regularly scheduled PowerPoint. So any questions on that, anybody? I just want to quickly go through the slides. I'm going to go through these slides quickly. It's not because I'm rushing. It's because these are just slides that are going to show what you've already seen. So again, we're building a new team. We're specifying the things that go in the team. That's what it looks like once the team is working. I get the little up arrow with the up green arrow. Then I'll say, let's look at it with PowerShell. New-netlbfo team. There's the name of the team. There's the members and the confirm. Other ones we can use as well. Any questions on any of this? There's an actual run, in case that hadn't worked. And tells me this stuff. There's my new netlbfo team. And how do I find the teams I have? Of course, it's going to be get-netlbfo team. And then afterwards, we see two versions of the truth. ipconfig shows us there's only one Nick. Interestingly enough, though, if you go into control panel, and you've been here before, right? This is a control panel. This is off of the network and sharing center. Doesn't the network and sharing center sound like a place where they've got milk and cookies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? Well, if you look, it still shows you that you've got these other guys, but it also shows you the team. So two different versions that you're going to see from different parts of your admin UI. Questions on that, anyone? Okay, great. Cool. Now, if you want to know how I got so smart about this, I downloaded and read, it's like a 54-page, I think it is, a white paper. It's, if you just search on 2012 Nick teaming deployment, and you'll get this information. So some really, really good stuff here. Any questions? Good. All right. You guys are quiet. That means I'm going to get this done on time.
Yay.
So I want to talk next about IPAM, IP address management. I don't want to sound negative about it. The people who built it gave it a high bunch of things to do. I mean, they had high hopes for it. And I honestly, what it does is it lets you manage your IP addresses, which is great. But it also gathers information about DNS, about your quarantine servers and your DHCP servers. And I just don't think it's necessarily that useful. But let's look at what I see as the really useful part. And again, everything I say changes in R2, because again, the what this does changes considerably. So it'll collect information on your IPv4 addresses. It'll suck information out of your DNS servers, your DHCP servers, and so on. I mean, how many of you keep track of your IP addresses with a spreadsheet? That's everybody, right? So that's great as long as it's IPv4. Has anyone here typed an IPv6 address by hand? That's not as much fun now, is it? So the steps are pretty easy. Basically, you're running a server that acts as a feature. It's not a role. And it goes out and interrogates servers. The problem is, or not the problem, but you know, the thing that gets in the way, is that these servers are by their nature secure. And so we have to go to them, and we have to amp up we have to dial down the security a bit. So before the PAM server can run properly, you need to go out to the other servers and say, listen, when the PAM server asks you a question, go ahead and answer it. There's two ways to do that. One is a manual configuration. You spend a lot of time noodling around in the registry. You got to create some new security policies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do not do this unless you're being paid by the hour, okay? Because it's going to take a long time. The better answer is that you can create group policies. You need one group policy to go to the DHCP servers, one to the DNS servers, and one to the domain controllers and quarantine servers. Again, you don't want to do this by hand. And there's some fairly strict rules for making them work. It could be a real pain in the neck if it weren't for PowerShell. So we have a PowerShell commandlet that will build them for you. And it's a pretty simple one. Invoke-ipam GPL provisioning, the name of your domain, the GPL prefix name. All of the GPOs need to have the same few letters in the front for the thing to work. And then the name of the IPAM server, that's the FQDN. And then dash force, because otherwise it'll say, are you sure? That will create the group policy objects. Link them to the domain. GP update everything. Do a resultant set of policies to make sure that everything's connected. And then fire up the IPAM wizard. The IPAM wizard starts out by saying, it's just kind of overview. It says, this is what we're going to do. Then the wizard says, how are we going to provision? How are we going to configure the servers? One option is manual. Don't do this if you value your sanity. Instead, use group policies. And so once you set up the group policies, it needs to know the prefix. Remember, we created a prefix for the group policies. Pretty simple. That's why I'm going through this quickly. Any questions? Once we do that, there's a little wizard you run, and it's got the six steps that you see here. Kind of funny thing about Server Manager is that Server Manager seems to like low-contrast screens. This is kind of like a powder blue against a bright white. So every time I run Server Manager, I'm reaching for the contrast knob on my monitor, but there hasn't been one for 25 years. So anyway. Those are some of the kinds of reports that you get. Again, it's keeping track of either your dynamic or static IP ranges. And the last piece of advice that I have is that you probably won't get PAM to work the first time. That's okay. I think it happens to all of us. Go back, remove the role, run some PowerShell to build those group policies, double check that they're applying properly. But mostly, remember the Galaxy Quest advice, never give up, never surrender, and you will prevail. Oh, one more thing it does, by the way, it's kind of cool. It takes a lot of setting up, but by turning on some audit policies, you can create a report of every IP address that a given user has used in the last month. So if you do forensics, that might be an interesting side effect from IPAM. Let me say that again. So if you want to get a list, is each of these people, these are the IP addresses each one used. So, question, yes?
Yeah, so
I said that things are going to change in R2 PAM. Why am I not talking, in Server 2012 R2, why am I not talking about that? Because I don't know all of it yet. Because they haven't told me. So, but this is a good talk this afternoon that I'll be at. And maybe you will be too. Okay? Other questions, anybody? Has anybody played with PAM? Has anybody set up an IPAM? No? Cool. I'm doing the job for you? No. That's my R2, it's going to be much better on R2. I could be a Microsoft guy. The next version is going to be great. Okay, I want to talk about DHCP failover. DHCP has always been kind of an interesting protocol. I mean, I remember the first time I saw it, because it was like the early 90s, and I had an internet domain. I was connected to the internet, and it was back in 1990 was when I first got connected. Now it was dial-up, you know, 14.4. So I was on the information superhighway, but I was kind of, you know, an unimproved country road. And, you know, NT came around, and it had IP stuff, and I was used to having a set up static configuration for all my machines, and that was annoying, you know. This DHCP thing comes along, I'm like, woohoo, this is pretty cool. I asked the guys at the ISP about it, and I wasn't getting any help from them because they said, oh, you're the Windows guy. Like, I must have been the only Windows guy within 300 miles that was trying to connect to the internet. And they're like, oh, no, it's a terrible operating system. Bill Gates is the devil. Don't you know? He's the devil. Buy a Unix box. Like, yeah, I'll get right on that. So DHCP came out. They actually told me that DHCP was a proprietary Microsoft protocol. I'm like, there's an RFC about it. So, anyway, so how many of you set up and run DHCP servers? Let me ask. Or have had to? Okay, good. Microsoft DHCP servers? How many of you run? Good. You'll like this then. You'll like this a lot. And how many of you ever track the way DHCP works? Because it was interesting. When the NT 3.5 technical resource manual came out, it talked about DHCP and it tried to explain it. And the way it explained it was, a machine wants an IP address, so what does it do? It broadcasts. I want an IP address. All the DHCP servers, this is the way I explained it, all the DHCP servers within earshot offer them addresses. So there's a number of offers. My favorite part is the client looks at the offers and chooses from the offers depending on a set of criteria. Anybody remember that text? What are the criteria that a client uses to pick a DHCP address? It's the first one it gets, yeah. I spent it like back in like 1997 or something, I spent a week with Network Monitor. I'm like, it's always the first, you know? It's fun what you hear about protocols, which is what they actually do. Because another one, too, is, has anybody here ever sniffed the network and watched DHCP? Do you ever do it when there's an iPhone on? Really? I did not understand this, and thank God Laura Chappell's one of my friends. You know, Laura knows everything about protocols. She hadn't been at a tech ed for a while. We need her back. Anyway, I said, what the hell's going on? I'd always heard, this is why I'm telling you this story, because when you do DHCP, you're going to be like, wait a minute, there's something wrong. I always heard discover, offer, request, acknowledge. So I'm the little PCO on an IP address. I broadcast, is there anybody out there? That's discover. The DHCP server says, you can have this address. That's offer. I say, ooh, that'd be lovely. May I have that? That's request. The DHCP server says, yes, you may. That's acknowledge. So discover, offer, request, acknowledge. DORA. Okay? I'm looking at some of these, and it's like going, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-ra. I'm like, what the? It's the iPhones. I didn't know you could do this. But apparently, you could do more than just say, oh, please give me an IP address. Apparently, you can also say, so listen, hi, I'm an iPhone. I need an IP address. And the thing is, like 3 weeks would be great. The four, we're going away for a while. It's kind of special time for me and my honey. And if we get the address down by the water, maybe in the shade, that'd be terrific. And swear to God. It's not exactly that, but it's the same idea. The DHCP server says, dude, no idea who you are, but the thing is, you're wireless, which means you get an 8-hour lease. Here it is. And the iPhone friggin' argues with it. I didn't know you could do this. It's in the RFC. I looked it up. The iPhone's like, eight hours, really? I'm committed to this. I've got to know that I've got this address, and I need it for 3 weeks. I mean, doesn't have to be top of the hill, but I mean, certainly a view of the water. And the DHCP server comes back and just pretty much says, if it's a Microsoft DHCP server, says, you're an Apple device. You should count yourself fortunate that I'm actually talking to you. And it just keeps saying, 8 hours, 8 hours, 8 hours. And after like four go-arounds, the iPhone goes, well, thank you. That'll do. It's, you know, it's not by the water, but I'm sure it's going to be perfect. Thank you so much. It's true. It's all true. No, the reason I told you that is that it really doesn't have to do it with this, but it has to do with the fact that if you're running a Microsoft DHCP server now and you're getting weird stuff in the logs, it's the wireless devices, and they start with app and end with lu. Okay? So it's a two-noder. It's going to be two machines, and the cool part is, has anybody here ever built a cluster of any kind, a Microsoft failover cluster of any kind? Okay, many of you, but for those who don't know, to make this work, the two machines or three machines or four machines, the idea in cluster talk, if I have one server is good, but if it goes down, I'm dead. If I have two servers looking out for each other, that's a cluster. And those servers are called nodes, N-O-D-E, on the cluster. Like Hyper-V, you can have 64 Hyper-V servers on it. This is a simple one, though. It's just DHCP. It's two nodes. Here's the beauty part, though. Most clusters need shared storage. Shared storage means something outside that they can all touch. Some kind of SAN, typically. If iSCSI rings a bell, that kind of thing. This doesn't need it. It's so simple. Couple of servers, and it doesn't have to be enterprise because there isn't any enterprise anymore. Microsoft took all the enterprise features, the $4,000 version, and put it in the standard $882 version. So very nice. Terrific stuff. Of course, then they took it back by charging us $72 per person per year for intern, but, you know. So all you got to do is set up a couple machines, and you set up the failover cluster, and it just works. It's cool. I'll show it to you. It only does IPv4 because I guess there's so many IPv6 addresses that it's not worth it or something. I don't know. So here's the story. We got two DHCP servers. We can set them up so they share a scope. Because I know what you're doing now. You're doing that 80-20 thing, right? You're doing that 80-20 thing where 80% of the scope's on one DHCP server and 20% on another. You're not supposed to do that. The RFC specifically says, you 80-20 people, stop doing that. Because in theory, there could be some problems. Anyway. And R2. R2 gave us a nice feature for that. R2 gave us a feature whereby the DHCP stuff got moved to India, to Hyderabad, about 7 years ago. And these guys do a great job. Like, we've had all kinds of great improvements. It's like they use the product. It's just absolutely amazing, you know? And so what they did last time before they got this working was they said, okay, if you're going to do the 20, if you're the 20 server, you could dial up a delay. So you could say, if you're my backup server, don't respond for 20 seconds or 25 seconds or something. That's a nice workaround. Well, what these guys found was that in 2003, somebody did a working paper in the IETF. Somebody did a working paper that never became an RFC with a way to do it. And they're like, let's implement it. I think you'll see they did a nice job. So we start out with two nodes, and they share the scope in some way. And by the way, they could do it 50-50, or they could do it 95-5. I mean, you could do a hot standby, like, I'm a DHCP server, but I'm not doing anything until you die. Or the alternative is, we just load balance. You just dial it up as you like it, okay? Starts out, there's three modes. The first one's okay. The second one is called communications interrupted. And the third one's called partner down. Partner down. Sounds like a 70s TV show. Partner down. So if a DHCP server goes offline and there's a heartbeat, first DHCP server says, server two, you okay? Yes, I am, server one. How are you doing? I am fine, thank you, server two. This is a heartbeat thing that goes back and forth. If one goes offline, the mode goes from OK to communications interrupted. All right? What happens at that point? The remaining node keeps doing the job, but if requests come in that normally the other guy would do, it answers those questions as well. So it takes the whole load. Now remember, though, if I'm one of the partners, I may only have 50% of the addresses. When I run out of my addresses, I start stealing from yours. But I don't know, because I'm hoping you'll come back. I mean, I visit you in the hospital all the time, bring you flowers, read to you, and I know you're going to be back any old time, partner, you know? But what I do is when I steal one of your addresses, I don't do like an 8-day lease. I do like a 2-hour lease. This smaller lease is called the maximum client lead time. And if you think about it, if you've studied DHCP before, you know that it is an acronym-rich area. Nothing has changed about that here. So MCLT is the maximum client lease time. And by default, we stay this way forever. So let me quickly do that again just to make sure everybody's with me. One partner goes down, other one picks up the whole load, uses its own addresses till it's burned out, until there's no more addresses, then starts to steal your addresses if you're the down partner, but uses a shorter lease, and this can run forever. Are we okay on this? We could take it a step further. If we take it a step further, we set a flag called the auto state transition flag and something called the auto state switching interval. What this now means is partner's down, clock's running. If the partner's down for 3 hours, we assume he's dead and go all Al Haig on him, you know? If the partner's down, we assume he's dead and we take control of the entire zone, the entire scope. Make sense? So by default, we stay in communications interrupted forever. If you flip that switch for the auto state transition and you set a time, it'll become official at some point. So that's our basic idea. Any questions on that? I'll get into more detail in a moment, but is everybody okay so far? Okay. Now, in theory, we could imagine a bad guy trying to insert a fake node into the cluster, a fake DHCP server with evil addresses or something like that. The way we get past that is that we sign those heartbeat communications. Signing a heartbeat communication requires a shared secret, and you just type one in, it's text. And for those that are tracking ports, that's TCP port 647. How do we make this work? Get two DHCP servers up on our cluster, authorize them, give it a name. Got to have a name. Every good relationship has to have a name. Benefer or something like that, right? Set up a scope on one of them and then do failover options. And I think I can show it to you. I think I have time to show it to you. Cool. So if I bring up my DHCP server, I have a DHCP server here on my .10 machine. Let's make sure I didn't mess up the IP. I'm going to ping the other guy, 10.0.0.90. Work. Okay, good. I think we're going to be good. And so There's my scope. I already set it up. If I right click, you notice I've got configure failover as an option. I'm going to do that, configure failover. Now, I told you that I love these guys in India because, like, they're great guys. They respond to emails and stuff like that. So I feel a little bad when I say, where did they get this page from? You know, the dark blue and the black? I haven't seen this since NT4. You know when it's got the little folder up there? Has nothing to do with DHCP? I know where they got that. From Clipart, from somewhere. And then it says, which scope do we want to do? There's only one scope, and that's the one that allows me to do. We're going to give it, he wants to know the name of the other partner. I'm just going to put in his IP address. Alternatively, I can search Active Directory and so on and so on. Goes out and finds it. I got to give it a relationship name. Here I can set the maximum client lead time. You see the default is an hour. I could choose, am I going to be 50-50? Will we have a state switchover interval? And if that's the case, how long? And then we're going to need shared secrets. So I'm just going to fill these in here. There's my relationship thing. Let's go to hot standby. Got 5%. We'll do a state switchover, and we'll cross over in 60 minutes. And now I got a shared secret. It then says, are you sure? Think about it. It sets things up. Life is good. Everybody's happy. Happy, happy, happy. And the interesting part is this. Let me switch back to the PowerPoint because, let me make a point here. So if I want to go back and change any of this stuff, like, you know, properties and such, you notice that, like, I can't change these things. I'm not sure why, but you can never get back to that dialog box. So there's that screen I showed you where we're configuring. Again, any questions on this? It's all pretty straightforward, I think, you know. There was that screen. It thought about it. And now it's got it working. If you ever want to reconfigure it, though, the GUI gets stupid on you. If only there were a PowerShell command. Well, the noun for DHCP clustering is DHCP server v4 failover. So because that's the noun, you've already guessed that there's a command to let you twiddle it called set-DHCP server v4 failover. Now, I don't want you guys to beat me to death, so I'm not going to take you through the PowerShell in great detail, but I do want to show you a couple of examples. That's a sample failover. Here you see a failover where it's just doing get DHCP server v4 failover. And it's showing me that my server's in a standby role, got 5%. We're in communications interrupted mode. We wait 15 minutes more, and we've gone from communications interrupted to partner down. Question I often get at this point is that if one machine hands out an address, how does the other one know? They regularly communicate with each other. So if one machine has handed out an address, the next heartbeat, it tells the other machine. But if you make a change, you change the scope defaults, if you change the server defaults, any of those things, that doesn't get synced up. So you can right-click the GUI and say replicate cluster, or just say invoke-DHCP server v4 failover replication. For those who care, set-DHCP server v4 failover gives me a lot of control in modifying the behavior of the cluster. Its name is going to be scope one clus. That's the name of the relationship. Dash auto state transition $true. I just said seize control. State switching interval 2 hours. Maximum client lead time 20 minutes. You can configure any of those things. And there's yet another example of how we can do this to force things into partner down mode. So if I could keep you for just another moment, please. This is my last talk. And I just want to say that I get to come here because you guys are so kind about letting me, and by the way, there's the QR. I'm begging you to do evaluations, please, because we're getting like none, and the conference managers are just going crazy about it. Two reasons. One is that I'd really like to hear that you liked it, you know, and if you didn't like it, I don't want to hear that, too. If you didn't like it, come talk to me. And the comments are important. I mean, whatever. If you really liked something, you know, type that down, write that down. If you really didn't like something, tell it as well. I hope that you enjoyed this. Hope I get to see you next year. Remember to use this knowledge for good and not for evil. Thank you. Thank you again. Thank you.